A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We are talking Wolford versus Lopez, which was handed down by the Supreme Court today. We're also going to be talking about the real-world implications of the Hamani case. Jones Walker attorney Dan Russell is with us. He is one of the attorneys involved in a Hamani-related case. This was a challenge that was actually brought back in 2021 by several individuals in Florida who either possessed medical marijuana cards and wanted to purchase a firearm, or gun owners who wanted to be able to use medical marijuana under the state law without violating 922G3. So Dan is very familiar with the issues in the Hamani case, because he's been dealing with some of those same issues in federal court in the 11th Circuit. I tell you what, before we get to Dan's interview, I do want to just go over some of the basics in Wolford. And then after we talk with Dan, I'm going to go back to the Wolford case. We'll skip today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivist report. We'll pick up those again on Monday. But I do want to do at least a semi-deep dive into the Wolford versus Lopez opinion. The big takeaway, of course, is that Hawaii's vampire rule that banned concealed carry by default on all private property that was struck down in a 6-3 decision. It was the lineup that you would expect, right? The opinion authored by Justice Samuel Alito, joined by Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, Clarence Thomas, Chief Justice John Roberts, the dissent from... Well, there were two dissents, actually. You had a dissent from Elena Kagan, very brief dissent that said, well, I think these, 18th century laws that Hawaii offered, I think they're close enough analogies that that the vampire rule should have been upheld. Then you had a dissent by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, joined by Sonia Sotomayor, arguing, well, this is not even really a case about the right to keep your arms. This is a property rights case. And the state has the authority to set rules around private property. And Justice Alito basically dismissed that argument by saying states don't have the right to infringe on constitutional rights in order to make laws around private property. So I don't think we're going to spend much time with the dissent. I do want to spend some time with the majority opinion, as well as the concurring opinion by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, which I think is pretty interesting. Now, a couple of things. The court had said from the outset that this was going to be a pretty narrow case. They weren't looking at any of Hawaii's sensitive places. The default rule was actually a different law. So they weren't going to strike down any of Hawaii's other sensitive places. What's worth noting, though, is that Justice Alito brings up a lot of these other sensitive places, as does Justice Barrett in her concurring opinion. And while they don't come right out and say, hey, all of these sensitive places are unconstitutional, it is suggestive that the court believes that a lot of these sensitive places that are private property are, in fact, not sensitive, and that it is not up to the government to ban firearms in those locations. It would be up to the property owner to prohibit firearms in those locations. Now, again, didn't come right out and explicitly say that, but that's certainly the impression that I got. One of the other takeaways from Wolford versus Lopez is a little bit more discussion, again, about the appropriate analogs that can be used to justify a modern gun control law. We got a little bit of that, too, in the Hamani decision, right? The how and the why of a older law. One, again, that was around in 1791, or maybe was around at the time the 14th Amendment was ratified. Does the how and the why of those laws closely resemble the how and the why of the modern gun regulation in question? And in the case of Hamani, when the government said, well, I mean, look, you had these habitual drunkard laws, you had these surety laws, the government said, no, not a close enough analogy. In Wolford versus Lopez, state of Hawaii had pointed to some 18th century laws that basically were designed to prevent poaching on private property. As well as an 1865 law adopted in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War in Louisiana that was meant to deprive freed slaves and freedmen of their right to keep and bear arms. And the Supreme Court today said, not close enough. An anti-hunting, anti-poaching statute that really wasn't meant to implicate the right of self-defense. Not a close enough fit. The Black Codes, they didn't come right out and say, hey, you can't use racist gun laws to justify a modern gun control law. But if you read between the lines, it's pretty clear that that argument and those laws should not get very far in terms of defending a statute that is in place today. So a good decision. Congratulations to Alan Beck doing a great job in representing the plaintiffs in Wolford versus Lopez. We're going to get again into some of the details about Wolford versus Lopez. But again, you know, last week, the Hamani decision comes down. Supreme Court says in the case of Ali Daniel Hamani, regular use of marijuana is not enough to prohibit somebody from legally owning a firearm. In fact, what the court said was that regular use of a drug is not enough to bar someone from possessing a firearm. If there's evidence of addiction, the court said, that might be constitutional. If there's evidence of active intoxication when somebody's caught with a gun, that's probably prosecutable under 922G3. They didn't call either of those things into question. But they did say that 922G3 was, it's unconstitutional as it applies to individuals like Mr. Hamani, who simply regularly use marijuana with no evidence of dangerousness. Okay, so how does that translate to the real world? I think Dan Russell's in a pretty good position to talk about the real-world implications of Hamani. It was a great conversation. I really appreciate him joining us on the program. Take a look and a listen. Dan Russell, thank you so much for coming on the program, sir. It's good to meet you.
Yeah, thanks, Cam. Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we scheduled this, didn't realize that today would be another Second Amendment Opinion Day at the court, but we've got Wolford versus Lopez. Last week, it was the Hamani case. And I don't know about you, Dan. I was not surprised to see the court find in favor of Ali Daniel Hamani. I was kind of surprised that it was a 9-0 decision, essentially.
Yeah, that was a lot of the conversation I was having with colleagues. We had a sister case to this. It was filed 5 years ago. We'll get into the history and how that played out. But to see it sort of our case via Hamani end 9-0. If you told me 5 years ago that was a possibility there was a case that would be ruled that way and be ruled at 9-0, I just said forget it. There's not even betting odds on that.
Yeah, I mean honestly, I mean just based on the questions we heard at oral arguments, I thought there was a lot of skepticism from Chief Justice Roberts, from Justice Alito. But you know, Alito comes out in his opinion and says, I mean, listen, you know, like it or not, marijuana is basically today like alcohol was back at the time of the founding. And there weren't any analogous laws like we see with 922G3 back in 1791 when it came to alcohol. Chief Justice Roberts did not write a concurring opinion. He just decided with the majority. So I guess it goes to show, you know, you can't always rely on what questions are asked during oral arguments to read those tea leaves. But let's talk about that case that you were involved with and you've been involved with 5 years ago. What were the particulars of that case, Dan?
Sure. So my practice we're based in Tallahassee, Florida, and Florida has had legalized medical marijuana for more than 10 years. And so we filed a case in 2021, and our clients were three individuals. We were working with two other firms as well, but there was three individuals. And then the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, which plays a role in regulating medical marijuana products, a small role. It's mostly regulated by the Department of Health. They regulate the production of edible products in Florida. They also regulate the issuance of concealed carry permits. Mm-hmm. So the Department of Agriculture was involved as well. So we had a former member of the military, a police officer, and a retired lady who lived by herself. And they were either in a position of, I have a medical marijuana card and would like to get a firearm, or I have a firearm and prevents me from getting a medical marijuana card. That was the individual plaintiffs. And so when that was filed in April of 2021, as you know, the law of the Second Amendment was very, very different. And our argument at the time was there's this rider in the federal budget that's been there since 2014 that prevents the federal government from spending a single dime to interfere with the legally active medical marijuana programs in the state. And so at the time in 2021, pre-Bruin, our argument was if you're committing a crime as a medical marijuana user under the federal system, but the government isn't allowed to prosecute you or even arrest you for committing that crime, have you really committed a crime? They were admittedly misdemeanors at the federal level. And as you can imagine, in a pre-Bruin court, our first run at trial didn't go particularly well. So we filed an appeal to the 11th Circuit. Between losing at trial and getting to the 11th, Bruin happens. And suddenly we have an argument that really holds water much, much better than it would have the day we filed it. And so at the 11th, we were successful. We went back down to the trial level, then Hamani. So we filed our case, and then everything that's happened since then has been tremendously helpful from the Supreme Court's down to the 11th Circuit and into our circuit in North Florida.
So this is still an active case, right?
It is still an active case. We were sort of on hold, having gone back to the trial level, waiting for Hamani. At this point, our case, which is medical only, these aren't, I guess you could argue misdemeanors at the federal level, but be that as it may, maybe not even anymore under the Schedule 3 context, another thing that happened between 2021 and today,
right,
that helped our case tremendously. It was great litigation strategy on our part to know all of those things were going to happen, right? So just adding to that, when you went Schedule 3, that made our case even better. So our clients are individuals who want to participate in the medical program. And now after, in a post-Hamani world where even the possession of illegal narcotics doesn't make you too dangerous to own a firearm, I think our clients, their case is effectively over. It is still actively litigating. It's not technically through with, mm-hmm. but for all intents and purposes, I think we've won.
So what is the prohibition right now? I mean, under Florida law, can those who possess a medical marijuana license, are they precluded from getting and again, Florida is a permitless carry state. But are they precluded under any sort of state law from lawfully possessing or carrying, or is it that 922 G3? That's it? That's the law in question that is tripping them up?
Yes, sir. That's exactly what it is. Everything in Florida, like to get a concealed carry permit, for example, it doesn't ask any questions about medication or illegal drugs or any of that. It really is just a background screening process mm-hmm. in summary. It was always that 922 problem at the federal level where the form, as you know, used to ask, are you in possession of illegal drugs? In summary, right? And then years ago, there was language added, the use of legal under state law marijuana products does not make it legal for the purposes of answering this question.
Yeah.
That's when everything got very particular for our clients who are in the medical space. They've always participated in their medical program, knowing that the Rohrabacher-Farr Amendment prevented the federal government from prosecuting them. They meet with their doctors timely. They follow state law. They are as compliant with a strict regulatory and statutory process in Florida as they can be. Their issue was always at the federal level, that 922G problem.
You know, and I mean, I've had conversations with people over the years, and we've seen even, I think, some folks in the press say, this is a law that doesn't impact many people. It really does. I mean, there are millions of Americans who have medical marijuana licenses. I think there are probably millions more in states where either recreational use has been decriminalized or you don't necessarily need a medical marijuana card to purchase marijuana. And frankly, even in states where, you know, marijuana possession remains illegal, that people are using these drugs not just to get high, but to alleviate, illnesses or symptoms of a medication they're taking for illnesses. And, you know, these folks, they want to stay on the right side of the law. So, no, they're not getting arrested because they're, again, in many cases, choosing not to own a gun, choosing not to use marijuana, or they're doing both and they're living in fear that one day they could get arrested. I mean, this is a legitimate issue. This isn't some sort of fringy issue that's only going to impact a very narrow subset of Americans, in my opinion. Do you agree?
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I'll speak. I know the specifics in Florida, so I'll speak granular level for Florida, which I think then speaks to the larger issue nationally. So Florida has one of the most robust medical programs in terms of sales and patient numbers. So there's more than 900,000 Floridians who have a medical marijuana card. And pre-Hemani, arguably, all of those people, knowingly or unknowingly, were not allowed to own a gun. And if you know Florida as well as I do, and I've lived here my whole life, more than one of those 900,000 people definitely have bought or owned a firearm during this period. And there's, you know, these are people who get up and go to work every day. They're taking their medication as recommended by their recommending physician, complying with particular statutes and state law, and are absolutely violating federal law every day, or at least they used to be. It's the same, you know, not to get political on it, but it's the same law that tied Hunter Biden up when he had gun and other drugs at his time. But it's the same part of the same provision of federal law that created that issue for them. And another sort of related issue in terms of, you know, we're in a medical use only state. There's adult use states and you know, there's a lot of those as well. But when the Farm Bill changed in 2018 and hemp was legalized in America, mm-hmm. we've all, if you've been to a liquor store or grocery store or a convenience store at this point,
yeah.
you've seen these THC-infused beverages everywhere.
Yeah.
And that's not our industry. Those aren't our clients. But the THC has become, it's ubiquitous in the United States of America. If you see alcohol for sale, you probably see THC in beverages now, which is, you know, this is the active ingredient in marijuana, medical or otherwise. It's now been legalized under the hemp bill. And I've thought for years, oh my goodness, the states or the feds are going to see this. It's not even a loophole. It's a Mack truck size loophole that they created in the Farm Bill. It's been out there for almost 10 years and we haven't closed it. I think mostly because people are making a lot of money selling those products.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, in Virginia, where I live, and they are trying to crack down on this, but you know, you got like the Delta 8, the Delta 9. I don't know what all the derivatives are. And you see them for sale in gas stations and, you know, convenience stores and tobacco and vape shops and things of that nature. And this, you know, so I mean, again, this is an issue that impacts a lot of people. And I'm curious. I mean, this was an as applied decision. So 922G3 still exists, and the Supreme Court was pretty, you know, they went out of their way to say this is a narrow decision. And in some aspects, I guess it is. In other aspects, it's not really, because the Supreme Court didn't say, hey, this only applies to marijuana users. They said, you know, as it applies to Ali Daniel Hamani, the law is unconstitutional. But they made it pretty clear. I mean, if you read the opinion, that drug use alone should not serve as a disqualifier, right? They talk about, listen, you know,
that's
if
right.
it's an addict, if there is, you know, evidence of dangerousness. But it seems to me that the court's ruling essentially says you can't just charge somebody with violating 922G3 because they smoke a joint a couple of times a week or they eat an edible before they go to bed. One of the cases that I think Justice Gorsuch noted, or if you, you know, borrow your wife's Ambien, you take one of your wife's Ambien pills. Technically, that's right. A 922G3, right? But he went out of the way to say, like, that's not what the statute is meant to go after. So even though the court says this is a narrow decision, how broad of an impact do you think it's going to have going forward, in your opinion?
I think it's very broad, actually. I mean, just in the marijuana context for the world I work in, I think it applies to every user. If it's, you know, our argument in 2021 was participation in a medical program makes you law abiding, and participation in the much, much more dangerous illicit drug trade doesn't. It also makes you more dangerous. It seems like that pendulum hasn't swung. The pendulum broke, where now medical patients are still law abiding, as we probably argued they always were. But for the purposes of it's a too dangerous analysis, right? It's we're not in law abiding, non-law abiding anymore. It's we're doing this weighing and measuring act of, okay, well, buying illegal marijuana makes you dangerous, kind of, but not too dangerous for Second Amendment analysis purposes. So
yeah.
Now I think the future of 2A litigation is, how dangerous is the person involved in that litigation? What are they doing that is creating this dangerous question mark? How dangerous are you? So like in the Rahimi case, we decided that someone who is abusing their spouse is too dangerous. And, you know, a policy aside, I think that's probably right. If you have a history of domestic violence, I think that is in and of itself dangerous versus your drug use, especially in a context of medical use or adult use, where you're just going to the store in a lot of states. You're not committing any crimes. There's no danger there at all. You could drop your kids off at school on a Monday morning, swing by your dispensary du jour and be home for coffee. There's nothing really dangerous that happens in that activity. Now, if that same person takes all of that marijuana and is brandishing a gun high, very dangerous. That's a different analysis entirely. I don't think people who are high any more than people who are drunk should possess a firearm in that moment, but right. Having it in a safe in their home without any access to it, I don't think that makes them dangerous. So I think the future of the litigation of this is weighing and measuring dangerousness on a scale to be determined.
I think that you're right. We're already starting to see that in like 922G1 cases. Although the court did not take up a direct 922G1 challenge this term, I was kind of hoping they would, because there were a couple of cases that, I'm very sympathetic towards the defendants. There was a woman named Melinda Vincent who wrote a bad check like 17 years ago when she was a homeless drug addict. And now she's a drug and alcohol counselor. She works with the state of Utah. She wants to own a firearm to protect herself and her kids, but she can't because even though she was sentenced to probation, it was a felony offense 17 years ago, so she's prohibited. I'd like to see the Supreme Court take up that issue. There are circuit court splits. I mean, you've got like in the Eighth Circuit, you've essentially got what you just described for 922G1 cases. You've got to have an individualized finding of dangerousness, right? And so, you know, an individual who is caught with drugs, and they've got no criminal record. Maybe they're taking these drugs for, again, medical reasons. They're probably not going to be found dangerous. Somebody who's found in possession of marijuana, they've got a felony record for gang-related activities. The prosecutor can prove that they're still actively involved in a gang. That individual may very well be determined to be dangerous, right? And I guess then the question becomes, how workable is that in practice, if a judge has to decide every case, okay, this person is dangerous or not, if a prosecutor has to prove in every case this person is dangerous or not, I mean, we already have a criminal justice system where, what, 97% of our cases, felony cases, are resolved via plea bargain. Right. Does this slow down? Does this gum up the works even further? How do you think this might impact how the criminal justice system works in this country?
Yeah, I mean, does it gum it up? Absolutely. And here's my opinion on the reason why. So pre-Bruin, there was a legal analysis on where, when, how, and who on a firearm, right? In a post-Bruin world, it becomes less about the law, the statute, the regulations, and more about the history books. Does this country have a history and tradition of disarming a person who does X? And we know now, post-Bruin, that it doesn't have to be exactly, if we were doing this in 1791, we have to be doing exactly that in 2026. I think that was always going to be the case. The world is a fundamentally different place for all analyses, including the use of firearms. But if in every single criminal case in every circuit in America, a circuit judge has to sit and effectively take a history lesson on, well, in 1791, here's what we were doing relative to this criminal activity. Here's what the defendant is doing now. And where does that defendant fall in the terms of dangerousness or not in a after Haman? It's somewhere between history of domestic violence and use or possession of illegal drugs. Is that area? Where's the hard line? I don't know that one exists. And another thing that was available to us when we filed in 21 is it wasn't even dicta. It was almost just like a postscript from Justice Thomas. And he was commenting on a marijuana case at the time. And I think he had said something to the effect of, this country now has a one foot out approach to regulating the use of marijuana in this country, which for many, many, many years has been the case. I mean, starting in the late 1900s, as my son says, Daddy, you're from the 19s, you know. In California, when they said, you know what we're going to do, we're going to make this medical and we'll see if the feds will come after us. And sometimes they did. But most of the time, as you've seen the progression of this, medicine or drug, depending on your viewpoint in this country, it's continued to explode, including today, where the president of the United States, via the federal government, has decided this is no longer Schedule 1, but they should determine it's a Schedule 3 drug that has medical use. And so, you know, long way to say, does it gum up the works? I think it does tremendously. I don't know if I'm a circuit judge in my circuit in North Florida. I don't know that I know what the law is anymore in terms of who's dangerous. I think if you lean on just the test of, does it scare me? You know, does somebody write in bad check? Does that person scare me? Not particularly. Does someone who's committed acts of violence through gang activity scare me? Yeah, I think that sounds pretty dangerous. And I think they would have thought the same thing in 1791. It may just get that simple. I just think based on the litigation history, that can't be the case.
You know, one last question for you, Dan. You talk about, the ongoing case in Florida, and this hopefully will be resolved judicially. How likely it is? I mean, again, this is a federal law in question, but there are a lot of, analogous state statutes in place. There are various rules around the country regarding, possession of marijuana and possession of firearms at the same time. Does Hamani, it seems to me like Hamani directly impacts a lot of these statutes. Do you expect to see a wave of post-Hamani litigation, in various states and legislation in various states to kind of resolve to bring these state statutes in line with what the Supreme Court said in Hamani?
I think so. And I think you'll have, just again, pure opinion, trying to read the tea leaves. Based on my experience, I think two things will happen. You'll have red states line up in a way that says, okay, we're going to lean towards access to a firearm. It's going to be pro-2A legislation that they think maybe pushes the boundary to be the test. And then in blue states, you'll have it the other way. In a post-Hamani structure, we can still limit guns this way. These people, we're going to say, if you do this, this, or this, you're too dangerous. And it'll work its way through the courts. And in 5 years from now, we'll get some guidance on what did this really mean? They'll go through the trial level, they'll go to their appellate level. And then a case like that, I would suppose in 3 to 5 years, gets its day in D.C. And I doubt there will be a 9-0 opinion on that one, put it that way.
I suspect that you're right.
Yeah.
Well, Dan, I hope that we don't have to wait 3 to 5 years to talk to you again. I really appreciate you joining us on the program today. I'm guessing in this particular case that you guys are litigating, you now go back to the court, you file supplemental briefs in light of Hamani. What's the next steps in your lawsuit?
Yeah, so we were on a stay pending the result in Hamani. So now we'll work with the Department of Justice's lawyers to lift the stay and see where the judge wants to take it from here. I mean, just, I think anybody who's read the case law and has seen where our clients are, we don't live in a world anymore where medical patients are too dangerous to own a firearm. We kind of need that formal resolution from the judge, but that's where we are.
Yeah. All right. Dan Russell, thanks again for joining me on the program, man. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much, Cam. Pleasure being on. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks again to Dan for joining us on the program. I thought it was a great conversation. I look forward to having him back again at some point in the future. All right. So let's turn our attention back to Wolford versus Lopez, if we can, for just a few minutes. You know, I mentioned before we shared the conversation with Dan that, to me, one of the broader takeaways from Wolford is going to be on the analogies that states can draw to previous historical regulations and modern gun laws. And it's worth noting that Justice Alito comes right out and spells it out for the lower courts before they even get into the analogies, that if the Second Amendment right is implicated by a modern gun law, then the presumption is that this law is unconstitutional, unless the state can show that there is a relevant national tradition and that this law fits within the relevant national tradition. And it can't be so broad as to say, well, you know, there's a national tradition of stopping bad people from doing bad things with guns, and therefore, right? Again, the how and the why matters here. And the reason why it's important that Sam Alito, again, restated in Wolford that if the Second Amendment is implicated, you start with the presumption that the law is unconstitutional and it is up to the government to justify these laws, is because we have had courts abuse that notion and say, well, I don't think the Second Amendment is implicated at all here. Look at Snoke versus Brown, the challenge to Maryland's assault weapons case, or assault weapons law. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals comes out and says, you know, the Second Amendment is just not implicated here at all, because the arms in question are not protected by the Second Amendment, because they're unusually dangerous, because they're military style. No, that gets it wrong. Does a ban on semi-automatic firearms implicate the Second Amendment, when the court has said that the Second Amendment protects prima facie all bearable arms? Yes, the Second Amendment is implicated by an assault weapons ban, and it is therefore up to the government to show, to demonstrate, that there is a national tradition of banning arms that are in common use for lawful purposes. And I don't think the governments can do that. So while this case doesn't directly touch on hardware bans, I think it does implicate these bans. And I think it's important that Justice Alito reiterated again what the standard is. He didn't directly call out any courts for ignoring that standard, but to me anyway, it was pretty clear that he and others of the majority have recognized that this is taking place. And that's a very good thing. Now, on to the analogs themselves. Again, the state of Hawaii had offered several analogs, and generally three categories. So you have the 18th century laws that were really designed to inhibit or prevent poaching. There was a 1771 New Jersey law that was called an Act for the Preservation of Deer and Other Game and to Prevent Trespassing with Guns, which said that a person could not, quote, carry any gun on any lands not his own and for which the owner pays taxes or is in his lawful possession, unless he hath license or permission in writing from the owner or owners. There was a 1722 New Jersey statute that had language similar to a 1721 Pennsylvania law, which was entitled an act to prevent the killing of deer out of season and against the carrying of guns and hunting by persons not qualified. As Justice Alito says, the state's analogs principally targeted unauthorized hunting. Their coverage differed sharply from that of the Hawaii law now before us. They applied to land where game could be found, not retail establishments that residents of cities and suburbs frequent as part of their daily routines. They had little, if any, impact on the Second Amendment's central objective, protecting the fundamental right to self-defense. And their obvious aim was to prevent the distinctive harms and risks associated with unauthorized hunting. That conduct often entailed the theft of private property. The poacher took game that the property owner might have otherwise harvested. It involved the firing of guns, which created a risk of inadvertently inflicting death or serious injury on the owner of the property, others who were authorized to use the property and livestock. At a minimum, the sound of the gunshots could surprise, alarm, or disturb the tranquility of others on the property. Alito goes on to say, the conduct restricted by the Hawaii law has none of these effects. Others on the premises will not even notice a person peacefully carrying a concealed firearm in the manner demanded by Hawaiian law. And note again something that Alito said in passing here. Doesn't directly implicate sensitive places, but I think it implicitly implicates sensitive place restrictions, particularly those that are carved out of private property. Alito says that these historical laws that were meant to prohibit poaching applied to land where game could be found, not retail establishments that residents of cities and suburbs frequent as part of their daily routines. Again, to me, that suggests that retail establishments that residents of cities and suburbs, and I'd say rural areas too, frequent as part of their daily routines cannot automatically become sensitive places. That again, there is a presumption that the right to carry is robust, that the right to carry protects the right to carry in places where we, the people, commonly go. That would include restaurants, including restaurants where alcohol is served. That would include gas stations, convenience stores, movie theaters, grocery stores, malls, retail shops. Now, again, if the owners of those properties want to prohibit firearms on the premises, that is their right as property owners. But the fact that Alito made reference to these locations, to me, is a sign that the court, if and when it takes up a sensitive places case, is not going to look too kindly on these broad prohibitions of a concealed carry, lawful concealed carry on private property. Now, it also means that they may take a more expansive view of the government's ability to regulate firearms or to ban the lawful carrying of firearms on government property. But I think that's an open question. As Alito wrote in the majority opinion, to test whether these analogs are, quote, relevantly similar to the challenge to Hawaii law, we may ask the question that was set out earlier. Because it was accepted that prohibiting unauthorized hunting on private land was consistent with the Second Amendment right, can we infer that it is also consistent with that right to ban a person who is lawfully carrying a concealed handgun for self-defense from entering a gas station, coffee shop, grocery store, or other private property open to the public without express and unambiguous consent? The question answers itself. The gap between the state's anti-poaching analogs and its new rule is just too wide. He then takes issue with the two remaining analogs that he says is even weaker. The first, 1893 Oregon law that prohibited anyone other than an officer on lawful business from being armed or trespassed upon any enclosed premises or lands without the consent of the owner. Alito says on its face, it's not even clear that the statute is relevant to the issue before us. Even if commercial establishments that are open to the public were considered enclosed at the time of the adoption of the Bill of Rights, no Oregon authority shows that the Oregon statute used the term to refer to such establishments. On the contrary, Oregon courts have interpreted that phrase, enclosed land, as outdoor land surrounded by a visible or distinctive line that demonstrates the separation from contiguous properties, so that a hunter would know to seek permission before hunting on that land. Moreover, he says the statute does not demand that consent be expressed. But even if the provision, he says, is read as Hawaii would have it, a lone statute adopted nearly a century after the adoption of the Second Amendment and well after the adoption of the 14th Amendment sheds little, if any, light on the meaning of the Second Amendment right. And then they get into the black codes. It says, finally, we come to the state's most remarkable analog. An 1865 Louisiana statute that made it unlawful for, quote, any person or persons to carry firearms on the premises of plantations of any citizen without the consent of the owner or proprietor other than in lawful discharge of a civil or military order. Now, again, on the surface, that doesn't appear to be too far afield of the Oregon statute or the New Jersey or New York anti-poaching statutes, right? So why is this the most remarkable analog in the majority's view? Alito says, regardless of this provision's pedigree, it has no probative value for present purposes. As we've said, in considering the probative value of a historical analog, we must consider whether it was widespread, well-known, and widely accepted. Because this statute was neither widespread nor widely accepted, it carries no weight. And he says, we could stop there, but there is another reason for rejecting Hawaii's reliance on this statute. It was adopted by the Louisiana legislature between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of Reconstruction. When the war ended, the legislatures in defeated Confederate states quickly enacted so-called black codes that aimed to perpetuate the subjugation of blacks. The statute, Hawaii cites, was part of Louisiana's black code, and it provided a tool for disarming blacks and thus leaving them defenseless against attacks. As we laid out in McDonald, he writes, the right to keep and bear arms was crucially important for vulnerable blacks during this period. And this was well understood by the Republicans in Congress who were responsible for drafting, approving, and securing the ratification of the 14th Amendment. The Republican Party platforms of 1856 and 1860 called for protection of the right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. Unless we put history entirely out of our minds, he writes, Hawaii's claim that this tainted artifact illuminates the original understanding of the right to keep and bear arms cannot be taken seriously. Now, why is that important? Because it wasn't just the Louisiana Black Codes that were the gun control laws of that time. You can look at almost every law dealing with firearms that was drafted and enacted in the former Confederate states between 1865 and, let's say, I mean, if you really want to be expansive, you could say right up until the Civil Rights era. Because all of those laws, or excuse me, I would say the vast majority of those laws had a racial purpose. And the racial purpose, even if they were written in a racially neutral way, was to prevent black people from exercising their Second Amendment rights, or to at least inhibit the exercise of that right. So when Alito says, you know, it's a really bad idea to cite racist gun control laws as justification for a modern gun control statute, that matters. Because I think it does call into question certainly the wisdom and I think the ability of defendants in these cases to go back to the Louisiana Black Codes or even, you know, laws that were written in the states of Texas or Arkansas or Tennessee in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, the permit to purchase law that was put in place in the early 1900s in North Carolina that the legislature repealed just a few years ago. Again, this opinion seems to say, if you're citing a law that wasn't meant to be racially neutral, that was, in fact, meant to deprive a certain segment of the American population of a fundamental right, we're going to disregard that. And that should be disregarded. I think that's pretty important. I do. And I think that it will hopefully resonate with the lower courts and play a role in future decisions here. Then we get to Justice Amy Coney Barrett's opinion, concurring opinion, which, by the way, Justice Clarence Thomas and Justice Gorsuch joined in part. We'll talk about that in a second. Justice Barrett said, I join the court's opinion in full, but I write to add a few points about why Hawaii's law triggers and fails Second Amendment scrutiny. And she says, again, Hawaii and its principal dissent, authored by Justice Jackson, insists that this is a case about property law, not the Second Amendment. She says the argument goes like this. No one has the right to enter private property, let alone to bring firearms onto it, without the owner's consent. Whether consent can be implied or must be expressed depends on local custom and property rules, which states have always had the authority to modify. And by requiring express consent, Hawaii has simply modified a default rule of property law. And because the pre-existing Second Amendment right did not require any particular default rule, Hawaii's law doesn't even implicate the Second Amendment. No further analysis is necessary. Justice Barrett says this argument misunderstands the role of historical evidence in a Second Amendment challenge. And again, keep in mind that Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas joined Justice Barrett in concurring to part of this concurring opinion. Barrett writes, Bruin establishes a two-part test for assessing whether a modern law is consistent with the Second Amendment. Each step requires a court to look at different evidence. Plain text at the first, right? Plain text of the Second Amendment. Is the right to keep and bear arms that shall not be infringed implicated by a particular law? And then if the answer is yes, okay, is there a national tradition that would justify this regulation that the government can point to? And that tradition can't be a handful of outlier laws, can't be laws that were in place for just a few years at a time, or laws that were in place in a particular part of the country, right? Widespread, well-known, long-lasting. That's what Justice Alito said in the majority opinion. Justice Barrett says, while history is relevant to both steps, it plays a different role at each one. We look to history that elucidates how contemporaries understood the text at Bruin's first step, the meaning of the phrase, for instance, bear arms. We save historical gun regulations, however, for Bruin's second step. In this case, she says, Bruin's first step is easily satisfied. The petitioners are members of the people. They wish to bear arms on a private property held open to the public. And she says that it is irrelevant for purposes of the amendment's plain text that a property owner has the right to exclude anyone who wishes to enter her property with firearms. No one doubts that all property owners in Hawaii could bar the carry of arms in their respective premises if they wanted to. But the Second Amendment doesn't apply to private parties. It does apply to the states. And when the state enacts a property law that regulates arms-bearing conduct, the law implicates the Second Amendment. So again, it's different if the owner of a restaurant wants to say, hey, don't bring your firearms in here. And the state of Hawaii says, restaurant owners, if you want firearms in there, you've got to let people know that they can bring their guns there. That's different, right? And Justice Barrett points out that this is different. Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting. So this is where we get into Justice Gorsuch and Justice Thomas joining Justice Barrett's concurrence. This is a part 2B of her concurring opinion. She writes, Hawaii also notes that several states enacted similar default rules in the mid to late 19th century. She says these laws get Hawaii nowhere. Once again, look to their why. Hawaii offers no evidence that the laws were designed to vindicate the community's aversion to people carrying guns in public. Nor is it plausible that they rested on such a basis. At the time, guns were commonly owned for self-defense and hunting, and that trend only increased when many Civil War veterans brought their weapons home. And while state courts often upheld gun regulations during this period, they did so because these states were pursuing specific regulatory ends, not because they were hostile to gun rights. She says, in fact, Hawaii doesn't dispute that most of the 19th century laws were understood not to address the carry of guns in general, but to curtail the freedom of blacks in particular. After the Civil War, the labor market in the South was a source of, quote, considerable irritation to the white landowning class. Newly emancipated slaves were, quote, prone to test their freedom by coming and going as they pleased. How dare they? And their liberty to forage, hunt, and fish for food reduced their incentive to work on plantations. Now forced to compete for black labor, white landowners resented how blacks could provide for themselves. So Southern states enacted a series of harsh laws known as the Black Codes to, quote, stabilize the black workforce and limit its economic options apart from plantation labor. Barrett says Louisiana was one of those states. In 1865, three of its local governments enacted sweeping measures that one observer described as restoring slavery in substance. Among other things, these ordinances prohibited blacks from renting or keeping a house within town limits, barred them from entering the town without permission of their employers, and forbidding them from carrying weapons without authorization. Fearing backlash from Congress, the state government opted for a subtler approach. In the fall of the same year, the Democratic-controlled legislature convened a special session and tasked a joint committee with proposing legislation to make freedmen's labor available to the agricultural interests of the state. The resulting package of the laws, she writes, were facially neutral. But no one was under any illusions about its true aims. As the eventual mayor of New Orleans remarked, the whole thought and time of the special session was given to plans for getting things back to as near to slavery as possible. And then she talks about one provision of Louisiana's Black Code, the default rule that Hawaii invokes today. She notes that Louisiana wasn't the only state to adopt these Black Codes. She talks about the Texas Black Code of 1866. And she says, it's beyond me why Hawaii would claim that these vile laws can justify its present-day restriction. She says, we can put aside the question of whether they're legitimate evidence of the Second Amendment scope, because regardless, they do not help Hawaii. The state seems to think that Bruin is a matching game. Southern states enacted broad default rules, Hawaii reasons, so it can do the same today. But even if Hawaii is right that the how is analogous, it must also identify as an analogous why. The Black Codes were enacted to subordinate newly freed slaves. Hawaii obviously does not contend that its law promotes an analogous interest. So its law and the default rules in the Black Codes are not relevantly similar. She writes, most would take that as a compliment. And then she says, applying old principles to new circumstances is not always easy. This case, however, she says, is not hard. While most Hawaiians might prefer that no one carry firearms in public places, a majority's opposition to a constitutional right is not a permissible basis for restricting it. After all, she says, quoting West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett from 1943, the very purpose of a Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy and to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials. The Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, is a fundamental right. It is a civil right as well. And that should not be in doubt or question after the Wolford decision, after the absolute judicial reaming that the state of Hawaii took for quoting the Black Code, one of the laws of the Louisiana Black Codes, to justify this ban. And again, I think that this was Barrett's concurrence. But I mean, I think Alito's majority opinion is frankly, just as strong. I think Barrett's concurrence simply twists the knife a little bit. That if these states are going to use, if they want to say that, hey, man, you know, there were a lot more gun laws in 1868. It was a different world than it was in 1791. The court hasn't said, listen, 1791 is the only time frame that matters. But I think the court has cautioned governments. You want to use 19th century laws? Okay. You damn well better make sure that they weren't meant to deprive a particular group of Americans from exercising their Second Amendment rights. And no matter how racially neutral they might appear on their face, you better do your history. Because we will be doing our history. And it matters. The why matters. So how many of these laws were meant to stop peaceable, lawful Americans from exercising their Second Amendment rights? Which is what Hawaii's law does. Which is what any broadly written gun-free zone, any sensitive place, any law that says you can't bring your gun into this gas station or grocery store or restaurant, or shopping mall. What is the why behind those laws today? Is it really to prevent violent crime? I don't think so, because violent criminals are going to ignore those laws anyway. It's to prevent people from exercising a right. And the why of those laws, far different than the whys of these laws in the 1800s. So, you know, again, on the surface, Wolford versus Lopez, you know, could be seen as a narrow decision. It really didn't strike down any law other than Hawaii's vampire rule. But I think that there is a lot in the dicta of this decision that bodes well for gun owners and will be cited by groups like the NRA, Gun Owners of America, Firearms Policy Coalition, National Association of Gun Rights, Second Amendment Foundation, in litigation going forward. Particularly Alito's comments about, you know, all of these places that are privately owned, which again is certainly suggestive of the idea that the government has no say in restricting the lawful carrying of firearms in those locations, that it should be up to the private property owner, but not the state to arbitrarily and unilaterally declare those places off limits to lawful carry. We'll see how many courts actually follow that advice going forward. But I gotta say, I am pleased not only with the bottom line of the Wolford versus Lopez decision. Obviously, glad to see the vampire rule struck down. Sad that Rob Romano and the vampire rule weren't actually cited in Wolford versus Lopez, the opinion, but I am pleased with the outcome. But I'm also pleased with the implications. And I hope that the court will not be too long in following up with a case that deals directly with some of the many sensitive places that have been declared gun-free zones since Bruin was handed down 4 years ago. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Buried Arms, Cam & Company. I'm always glad to end the week on a high note, and I'm not just talking about the Hamani case. Hope that you have a fantastic rest of your week. Great weekend as well. We'll be back with you on Monday. Again, a reminder, next Tuesday, we may not have a show. I may try to pre-tape one early. I'm still kind of up in the air about it, but I'm going to be up in Washington, D.C., and doing an interview with ATF Director Robert Sakata and ATF General Counsel Robert Leiter. You'll see those interviews in the coming days here on Buried Arms, Cam & Company, in the podcast. But I will be with you on Monday, and we'll be talking more about the latest Second Amendment news and issues across the country. Probably going to be focusing on Virginia or Rhode Island, maybe both, because Wednesday of next week, Virginia's ban on assault firearms and large capacity magazines takes effect. Rhode Island's ban on so-called assault weapons takes effect as well. They passed that law last year, but the effective date is actually July 1 of this year. And yeah, these rights are being infringed in a very big way. And I feel a little bit better, honestly, about the Supreme Court hopefully taking a challenge to one of these gun ban cases, but also ruling in the right way. Because remember, Chief Justice Roberts was a part of Justice Alito's majority opinion, which means that he should mean anyway that he stands by with what Justice Alito wrote. And I think if you look at what Justice Alito said today, there's a lot of positives to take away beyond the vampire rule being struck down. All right. Until we talk again, be well, be safe, and be free.